This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
Welcome to Arctic Connections, Episode 3, Arctic Infrastructure and Defense, featuring Dr. Kelsey Frazier and host Matthew Hickey. As Arctic sea ice melts and new shipping lanes open, nations are racing to secure their interest in this once remote region. Recent developments, including increased military activity and infrastructure investments by countries like Russia, the United States, and China, are reshaping our understanding of Arctic dynamics. This episode explores these changes and more.
Dr. Kelsey Frazier, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to Arctic Connections.
Yeah, good to be here.
It's good to have you. It's always good to see you. Today we're going to dive into a topic that's not only critically important, but increasingly relevant in our rapidly changing geopolitical landscape. And that's the intersection of Arctic infrastructure and its implications for national security. Maybe we could call this episode the Arctic Kitchen Sink, because I'm going to throw just about everything at you.
I like it.
But you're an expert in this matter. And what I mean about this matter is today's headlines very much focus on the geopolitical activities in and around the Arctic region. Mm-hmm. The headlines, you know, very much focus on great power competition. Russia and China jointly patrolling off the coast of Alaska. These are very much geopolitical events, yet much of this is undergirded by the geophysical changes driving a lot of these processes. You, I feel, of all people, are uniquely postured and qualified to talk about how these two are connected. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're at now, and why I might be here labeling you as someone that could connect these two important issues, the geophysical and the geopolitical here in the Arctic.
Sure, absolutely. You were very complimentary in that introduction, and usually I don't think of myself in that way, but I have a PhD in mechanical engineering, and I spent a lot of time studying sea ice in the Arctic and its form and function. And the reason I was engaged with that was a question that came up a few years ago of, if there is an oil spill in the Arctic, because we had just gone through the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, but if that was somehow in the Arctic, how do we approach cleanup? Because, you know, in the early days of Gulf of Mexico, everyone and their brother was on a boat cruising towards the oil, throwing out booms to kind of contain the mm-hmm. contamination. But you had 4,000 people on the water immediately. You're not going to have that in the Arctic. And so all of these questions came up of, well, okay, could we model where the oil slick goes? Could we send people out there? Well, what's the ice doing? And then suddenly there was this great conversation between the modeling community that was looking at how to make a sea ice model and the oil spill community that would model where the slick went. And they both went, ah, crap, we don't know what's going on underneath the ice. We don't know how the oil might move beneath the ice. And so that was the genesis of a PhD. And at the end of that, you know, we can reasonably now predict how an oil slick might move if there was a catastrophe in the Arctic. And so that's how I got started in all of this. Right now, I run a research group here at the Ted Stevens Center. We've got a team of 8 researchers at the moment that cover everything from legal and lawfare aspects to biological science, to history, and everything in between. And so it's been a really great kind of career trajectory to look at that confluence between the core or basic science that's looking at the universe and trying to understand what's going on, and the operator in the field going, can you just tell me how this is going to behave or what I can and cannot do? And marrying those two topics together is really where I sit and where I see my expertise.
So this geophysical change is happening. Mm-hmm. The latest reports seem to indicate that the Arctic is warming 3 to 4 times faster than the rest of the world, which then leads to the reduction in sea ice, ice melt, shipping lanes open, and we could follow that narrative in one direction. At the same time as activity increases, so the risk of miscalculation between entities operating there or the risk of accident seems to increase from where you sit. Are nations prepared for what is now the future in the Arctic, where it's more operable, there's more activity, and more could go wrong, from oil spills to anything else?
Some nations are very well prepared. Those are the nations that have been active in the Arctic for a long time. I think that Norway, Sweden, Finland are very well prepared. That is their home. That is where they spend the majority of their time. Nations like Canada, also fairly well prepared, probably more so in my estimation than the United States. The United States does a really great job of ground and air maneuverability, but when it comes to surface of the Arctic maneuverability, you know, we all know the conversation around icebreakers. We have one icebreaker that's working, and there's this hope that we're going to have more icebreakers. And you know, the benefit of having an icebreaker, even with a reduction in sea ice, is that the sea ice will never completely disappear. If it does, we're going to go the way of the dinosaurs, and you and I will not have conversations. But there will always be some ice. And so you're always going to need to be able to have a capability. So are we prepared? Maybe. Now, we look at what Russia's doing. They're obviously keen to make sure they've got a capability, but, you know, how well are they equipped for that? And how good is the technology that they're employing? I would point out that just recently we had a massive ice-capable cargo ship that Russia allowed to go through the Northern Sea Route, mm-hmm. Flying Fish 1. But then they gave a permit last month to a non-ice-hardened cargo ship. So you have a massive mm-hmm. cargo ship transiting the Northern Sea Route where it's still cold. We still have limited satellite coverage. They don't have an ice escort. And we're like, yeah, we'll just see what happens.
And so I think it's important to put this into context. This, what you're talking about, is something that has never happened before, or is this?
No.
This is new.
Brand new.
Okay, non-ice hardened ships sailing through along the Northern Sea Route at the permission of mm-hmm. Russia. Now I know there's a lot there to get into,
sure.
Whether they are, you know, technically allowed to give permission or who has the authority to
right.
say what is right and wrong up there. Maybe we table that for a different conversation. But what you're talking about is that because the ice has receded to a certain extent in Russia's desire and need for economic development, they are now encouraging
yeah.
and or the, just the fact that it's happening, non-ice hardened ships are sailing through there. Okay, tell me why this matters though.
It matters on multiple fronts. So first, as an Alaskan, I would say they're eventually gonna pop through the Bering Strait. Are they going to run into indigenous populations who are also out there fishing and harvesting food? Are they going to ground somewhere that's going to contaminate Alaskan and U.S. soil? I look at it from an economic perspective of, is there enough of the right insurance in place to ensure that if there is a catastrophe, we have some type of economic compensation going on? And then at the lowest bar, just search and rescue. If something happens, who's going to respond? Mm-hmm. You know, on the U.S. side, the nearest vessel that we might be able to send out is either Seattle or Kodiak, maybe Dutch Harbor, depending on the time of the year. That's thousands and thousands of kilometers away. So if the Russians aren't close enough and we have a Chinese cargo ship out there, are we flying out? Do we know? Have we actually exercised that so that we've got either a policy in place to deal with it or just activity?
I think you're doing a nice job drawing a connection between the geopolitical and geophysical here. And I guess what I'm hearing a little bit is you have a Russian economy that they're very much in a war economy right now, trying to generate as much revenue via their
yeah.
Arctic
yeah.
resources as much as possible.
Sure.
And to do that, they're transiting those materials along its coast through the Bering Strait and into China and to some other countries,
uh-huh.
but we'll focus on that for now. So this sort of transit corridor is motivated by Russia's need to get these resources to market,
sure.
while at the same in order to basically fund and fuel its war machine,
right.
While at the same time, the very act of transiting this material
mm-hmm.
presents an environmental risk.
Yeah.
To an area near Alaska, or really the entire Bering Sea, that is rich in
fish,
crab,
all kinds of resources.
So let's then, all that being what it is,
yeah.
and that kind of being on the table, that being the sort of the playing field in that particular part of the world. We call it the North Pacific, or the gateway to the Arctic through the Bering Strait. Let's transition a little bit then and talk about some of the things that the United States is doing about it, or at least has put down on paper.
Sure.
So a couple years ago, the National Strategy for the Arctic Region was published. There's now an implementation plan for that. And this summer and in the fall, the Department of Defense released an updated Arctic strategy. Now, I think when people hear of a DoD strategy, mm-hmm. I think a layperson might think, okay, we're going to maneuver forces from here to there. And that's very much part of strategy, is moving pieces around the proverbial chessboard. But to stay on topic here, a lot of the strategy, both documents, don't just focus on where, say, forces are, specifically speaking to the DoD, but there's a lot of science and, frankly, infrastructure discussion in the strategies themselves. Why is that important in a strategic document?
Part of it is just, I think, what DoD would term domain awareness. Do you know enough about the environment to make an informed decision so that your people and equipment are going to be safe? And that requires the science. So whether you are going to operate in the winter, in the summer, in one of the seasons in between, you need to know, well, what's the temperature? What do I need to pack? Is the ground solid? Can I build a temporary port? Am I going to be able to land something on a runway? Is there a runway available? You know, all those pieces come together for the logisticians to move those parts around. And what I'm really excited about in the current document is this push to not only include science in the conversation, but also the local communities in that conversation. Mm-hmm. Because so much of what we know about the changes going on starts with what's being observed. And someone saying, hey, by the way, that thing over there, not solid. And then the scientists come out and go, well, here's why that's not solid. And then we can tell DoD, hey, don't stand there, land there, put something there. And then it's up for DoD to decide. So that combination of communities and scientists and DoD practitioners really allows them to strengthen their position as they move into the Arctic.
Yeah, so let's let's pull the string on one of the terms you used there, and that's dual-use infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Okay, on the surface, it seems kind of self-explanatory. Dual, meaning two or maybe many, and infrastructure, something physical. I mean, yeah. I guess maybe we could define it, you know, include some sort of cyber into that as well. But even cyber requires some sort of physical infrastructure somewhere in order to function properly. So, dual-use infrastructure in the Arctic in the context of these strategies. Okay, if I just sit down and think about it for a second, I might surmise that, well, there must not be an adequate amount of infrastructure in this particular location, either being the Arctic writ large, Arctic adjacent. It doesn't necessarily have to be 66 degrees north. It could be kind of, you know, a little bit further south than that. Areas in this general vicinity of the Arctic. Okay, so where are we at in terms of infrastructure in the Arctic region? And let's just keep it narrowly focused to Alaska, the U.S. Arctic, or the Arctic region in and around Alaska. Or maybe North America, because there is some connection there. Where are we at, and where do we need to go? Mm-hmm. While also taking into mind that the environment's changing. So any infrastructure that's built, especially in the Arctic, a place that's warming at 3 to 4 times the rest of the world, as we've already discussed, I mean, that it's already a challenge to begin with, mm-hmm. to build an infrastructure in the Arctic for a list of reasons. But then to think that it's all changing at the same time.
Right.
What sort of challenges are we facing here? And what can we realistically do? And then really, you know, what is dual use?
Yeah, absolutely. So where we stand in the Arctic, at least in Alaska, if we ignore DoD influence, if we ignore all of the geopolitical players, and we just say, okay, are the communities here prepared? The answer is no. They're moderately prepared, but we are still missing things like critical roads, airport maintenance, indoor plumbing is a huge one, electrical grids that are tied into larger grid systems. You know, right now they're kind of smallly contained in these communities. And so lacking that, the communities are, say, 70% of what you and I might expect if we move to Seattle. Now we talk about the geopolitical influence layered on top. So now we want to increase our observation. We want to increase personnel that might be someplace. Well, now you're taxing water and wastewater, mm-hmm. you're taxing cellular service, satellite communication, all of the things that weren't strengthened to begin with. And that provides unique challenges, especially if these aren't permanent people that are going to stay there. So you want to go do training in Nome, Alaska. Okay, fine. But you're going to take 300 people and put it in a community that was already taxed? So those are, that's the yeah. the makeup of the challenge at the moment.
And to be clear, I think you made a fundamental assumption there. I just want to point out, the people that live in the region and the, mm-hmm. the military personnel that are asked to operate there are incredibly resilient and capable yes. using what they have.
Oh, yeah.
But sometimes they don't have everything that they might need,
mm-hmm.
especially as we maybe as a country look to expand a presence or capabilities in the region. So let's just point out one of those
yeah.
locations. A place that gets a lot of attention, or maybe more attention than others, is Nome.
Mm-hmm.
Nome, Alaska, on the Bering Sea. And that's because of the port that's
yeah.
under development there. So let's use Nome as an example. There is some infrastructure. You and I can go to mm-hmm. Ted Stevens International Airport, get on a commercial flight, and land in Nome. But then what then?
Right.
After you're there, if a port is built, what is lacking, what is changing, and let's use Nome as an example of how there is some infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
but there might need to be more. And that more infrastructure might need to serve multiple purposes, not only for maybe civilian and military capabilities, but also for the people who live in the community mm-hmm. itself.
Yeah,
I can touch on some of that.
The port is a good example of that dual use idea. Dual use infrastructure is gaining momentum in the, you know, at least in the last 5 years. And the idea is that dollars are limited. You know, everybody's lacking in funding. So how do we work together to accomplish common goals? And one of those common goals for Nome is having an expanded port. If they have an expanded port, they can bring in cruise ships, which brings in extra dollars, supports the economy. Great for public causes in Nome. But that expanded port would also allow for U.S. naval vessels or U.S. Coast Guard to show up. So now we have both a community civilian use and we have a DOD use, and they're side by side. And that's the idea around dual use infrastructure. How do we identify a common goal, build it, and then allow both parties to kind of maneuver around each other for the greatest common good. And I hope that Nome will be one of those examples where we go, this was done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
There are some challenges though.
Right.
There's no road in and out of Nome connecting it to the rest of Alaska.
Right.
There's no railroad. So once you establish the port of Nome, if you wanted to bring goods in, you have to fly them in or barge them in the
right.
summer. So we're missing some of those pieces. And if we're going to build a railroad or build a road, which would be impossible for a lot of reasons, can we make that dual use?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that going to be for military transport and civilian transport and maybe even commercial economic transport?
So a lot of challenges overlap in each other. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you have a port. A lot of consensus is a port is necessary in or near the Arctic. And so,
yeah.
okay, let's port of Nome. That sounds like a good spot, and it is a good spot for many reasons, but at the same time, putting the port there creates a new set of problems. How do you connect it? Sounds like you could maybe build a road, but it'd be hundreds and hundreds of miles
yeah.
over challenging and complex terrain that all the while is changing, and there's legal elements of it too that would be considered. Well, maybe a rail, same sorts of challenges. How do you get out there? I mean, it's difficult to even get airplanes in there. I mean, yes, you can fly commercially, but the runway is limited. And so when you think about putting whether it's cruise ships that dock there, whether it's an icebreaker that comes in, there's shoreside infrastructure that needs to be there, which then, as you mentioned, requires all the other services that are necessary. So on the surface, sometimes it's yes, it's a very binary answer. It seems
sure.
like yes, it's necessary to have that sort of infrastructure there, but then the infrastructure needs to be supported by other infrastructure, which
mm-hmm.
needs to be supported by other infrastructure,
yeah.
so on and so forth, and on we go with a very challenging problem, which we could continue to dive into, and we'll talk about a little bit more here, but I do want to just take a step back to give you a chance to take a breath, and we'll shift gears here. I like to ask all the guests that come onto the program a few questions about the Arctic in particular, have a little fun, and give some tidbits of information to people listening that they might not otherwise get. Uh-oh. A question such as, what's your most enlightening or favorite Arctic fact? Or, you know, something that is sort of a misnomer. People think about the Arctic that's not true. And you can't use the penguins example.
Well, there's no penguins in the Arctic, so. Okay, fair enough. We won't talk about penguins. I love the fact that the name for the Arctic comes from Greek, and it comes from the concept of the Greek word for bear. And so it's kind of interesting that we have the bear pole and the non-bear pole, because we have the Arctic and we have the Antarctic. So I don't know. I suppose that would be my favorite fact of how we, in the English European side, got the name for this place that we inhabit.
That is interesting. There's a lot of ways you could take that fact and dive into some very interesting conversations, especially when you start bringing in Greek philosophy and origination of words. All right, you've traveled the Arctic. What's your favorite town in or near the Arctic, or in an Arctic country?
Oh, in an Arctic country? That's a toss-up, but I'm going to have to say Tromsø, Norway. Probably my favorite spot on the water. Gorgeous vistas, cold, great northern lights, fantastic food. I hope we can replicate that in our Arctic one day.
I believe Tromsø is known as the Paris of the Arctic, if such a term is permitted. I don't think anybody asked Paris about that, but why Tromsø beyond that? Is there a particular location you direct people to go to if they happen to be in Arctic Norway?
I don't know if there's a direct location, but there's something very lovely and pleasant about being out on the water. And there, I guess 2 years ago, I took this sailing cruise when I was in Tromsø in January. So, you know, you're in a parka on a sailboat and you're out in the harbor, and we were looking for northern lights. And I was there with a girlfriend of mine, and it was just so much fun. It's not an experience that we have in Alaska, because our version of the Arctic is so ice intensive, and their version of the Arctic is a little bit different because of changing wind patterns. So the fact that you could, in the winter, be out on the deck, looking at the stars, just having that moment with nature, that was spectacular.
Well, so even in that story, paints a pretty dramatic geophysical contrast between two different Arctics at the same latitude in Europe. Compared to that in North America, one, you're able to go out on the water, and the other one, the water would be frozen and thus sea ice if you were in a different part of the planet. Okay, last question. The best book you've read recently?
Oh, you assume that I have time to read books.
Maybe the best thing you've read.
There are some new papers that have come out. I'm uber nerd, okay? Look, researcher. I'm like, look at these great academic articles. There's a couple of really great articles that are out, and they talk about changes in the permafrost and the ability for permafrost to heal. Mm. So we talk about permafrost being this thing that's melting and it's gonna go away. But it doesn't have to. And so there are some interesting experiments and investigations into, how could we increase permafrost in the Arctic?
We can hang that on the page there if our captive audience is interested in such a thing. It does sound fascinating, and nerds are important too, right?
Okay. We're here to explain the science.
Let's refocus ourselves here. What's coming up? And before we talk about what's coming up, then let's talk about what's happened in the past. And one of the ways, if you're involved in Arctic security and Arctic policy, you know that there's a very robust circuit of Arctic events, conferences, seminars, symposia, and the like. And there's one coming up, and there's one that just happened that you attended and I've attended. Upcoming is the Arctic Circle Assembly in Reykjavik, Iceland. What happened last month was the Arctic Security Conference in Oslo, Norway. As I mentioned, you are going to be involved, and you were involved at both conferences, not just in attending, but in an active role as a panelist, as a moderator, and in other facets. both very different events. Arctic mm-hmm. Circle Assembly, very large, very broad, sometimes security, sometimes much more wide-ranging. And Oslo was very focused, a smaller conference, very much focused on Arctic security, almost a foreign policy conversation. Yet in both, there's a large presence of science-focused panels. Whether you're talking specifically about security and foreign policy, or whether you're talking about the Arctic writ large. Why?
That's a fantastic question. And my answer to you is that as scientists, often, academia is not trained to explain why what they're doing is important, just to the general public. Mm-hmm. And on the defense side, we have this need for information. Just give me information. And a lot of what I do at these conferences is explain how the science informs the policy, how the science informs the defense side, and then conversely, what the defense or the policy side need from the scientists. It's this marriage or communication between these two entities. And the part that I love about going to all of these different conferences is that as I talk with different groups of people, as I talk with ministries of defense, as I talk to academic circles, what I'm trying to discern is where are the gaps?
Yeah.
Where are the things that we're talking about and where are the things that we're not talking about yet?
So let's point out a couple of those. I think in Oslo, your panel was titled Local Arctic Insecurity. Mm-hmm. Geopolitical consequences. So to kind of pull that apart, I could read between the lines or read the line and say geopolitical consequences if or of localized insecurity. Sure. So to kind of bring us back to the beginning of the conversation, most people say, oh, look at, there's great power competition in the Arctic, very much this big geopolitical, geostrategic sort of thought cloud here that we can focus on. Yet this panel that you participated in seems to make the argument that insecurities at the local level, be it, you know, food security, economic security, or even to bring it to infrastructure, lack thereof, can have geopolitical consequences. Sure. And that's sort of some of the things that we're talking about here, which is why it's relevant to bring up at both security conferences such as Oslo and the bigger, broader conferences in Iceland.
Absolutely. And the reason why that's important to talk about is because there's a disconnect between maybe what you and I consider security and what a local community considers security. Mm. So if we had you and me sit down and say, you know, list the 10 things you need to be secure, and we had a local Alaskan community do the same exercise, probably a quarter.
Or even a country that says, here are the 10 things.
Yeah, a quarter of those are probably going to be different. And if we as the United States don't know what those insecurity elements are, that presents an opportunity where you have an issue going on. Say you have a typhoon that blows through. You know, we have hurricanes in Florida right now. So we have a typhoon that blows through and the community's drastically worried about a security measure that the rest of the US hasn't even thought about yet. Hmm. And so who's gonna fill that gap over here? Well, an adversary could come in and do that. You know, somebody who has nefarious purpose could come in because they know that that's an insecurity issue, but the U.S. is blind to it. And so
real quick, at Arctic Circle Assembly in Reykjavik, in just a couple weeks here, you're going to specifically be speaking to what?
We're going to talk about some of those aspects that really aren't encapsulated by either U.S. policy or U.N. policy.
And so in some ways, we've rehearsed a little bit of your...
I appreciate you asking me all these questions. That's right.
Well, very good. I think you provided some tremendous insights here today. There's a lot. This is a very complicated topic, hence the Arctic Kitchen Sink nickname for the conversation here. Kelsey, thanks for your time today. Thanks for the work that you do. And we look forward to chatting with you again.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Okay.